Hello, this is Jesse Liberty, and this is yet another podcast. Today I'm talking with Jeremy Lickness, who is a Microsoft Silverlight MVP, a certified Silverlight developer, and who works as a senior consultant and project manager for Wintellect. Jeremy is also the brains behind the Sterling database that runs on Silverlight on the desktop and on Windows Phone. Did I get that right, Jeremy?
You got that right.
Great. Welcome.
Thank you. Excited to be here.
How long have you been working with Wintellect?
Wintellect about a year and a half now.
They're really a very impressive organization.
They are. I can say that as an employee as well. I've had a great time there.
So I have to say that I discovered Sterling when I started to look a little bit more deeply into what can be done for creating a database on Windows Phone. And what I found, and you'll have to correct me here if I say anything that's not technically accurate, but what I found was that isolated storage is a great way to maintain any kind of state that you want to persist after the application is closed, but that it's essentially name value pairs. And if you want a real database with relational tables, then you're going to need to look at a system like Sterling that would run on top of isolated storage.
That's essentially correct. Definitely there's a couple other problems with the settings that are built into isolated storage as well. So there's really two layers, if you will, to it. One is the settings that people are familiar with, and that is just the name value pair. And that comes with some of its own interesting nuances because it's actually flushed to storage and loaded into memory all at the same time. So you've got some severe limitations for how big that can be. And then your other option is, of course, the file system in isolated storage. And that's exactly what Sterling sits on top of and takes advantage of.
When did you start working on Sterling, and what motivated you to take on this project?
Well, I actually started, and a few people are surprised for this because it's been so popular on the phone, but I started before the phone was even in the picture, before it had been publicly announced, and I was working back in the Silverlight 3 days. And we had just come over to Silverlight 4, and I was working with a lot of customers who were excited about Silverlight as a way to get applications on OS X and Windows machines. So they liked the cross-platform, and what they liked even more was this offline mode that you could run it when it's not connected to the network. But even on the desktop, we had this issue where there was no native database, and so I found that, you know, everyone was basically storing objects to isolated storage and bringing them back, which was fine until you get to 10,000 records. And then you start to have issues. And so to address those issues is really when I started building the engine to have something that would let me query quickly so I could look at the fields I want to look at, like in a contact record, for example, a last name, but not have to deserialize the entire object until I actually wanted to look at the full thing.
And you mentioned that 10,000 limit. What are the practical limitations on a Sterling database?
There's obviously a lot of factors involved with the size of the object. I've had people report to me that they're using it with somewhere around 50,000 or more records. Personally, I've taken it up to that limit. I imagine it could scale beyond that, but it's really a balance of, again, how large that object is and what the size of the key is. Because the way Sterling does its magic is it stores keys and indexes in memory so you can perform linked to object queries over them. And basically, if you have even 50,000, say, names, which are strings to query over, that's really not a huge memory footprint, and it's practical. When you start getting into the hundreds of thousands or even millions, then it's definitely not the right solution. And I would even argue that it probably doesn't make sense to have that much data on the client anyway. That's probably something that should be handled on the server and sort of sent to the client as needed.
No, I couldn't argue with that. I guess the question is, if I focus on the phone, the memory footprint becomes a lot more critical. And that raises the question of, well, why are people putting data on the phone in the first place? I can think of one use case right off the top. We're building in the full stack application. We're building an application that is going to write its data back to the server, but we can't know that we're connected. And so one of the things I'd like to discuss with you is how we would go about using Sterling as a repository on the phone that can update the database in the background. Is that something that Sterling would be useful for?
It is, and it's actually interesting that you bring it up, and I wanted to talk to 2 points because you brought up something earlier in that. First is that it can be used for synchronization, and we're actually looking at ways to make it more first class in the sense that there is the Microsoft Sync framework and there's some other well-established patterns out there for doing that. So I've had a lot of conversations with people around that. The other point that you mentioned on the phone, when we're talking about a practical limit on the phone, I agree with you that the memory is critical. And another important thing to keep in mind on the phone is that the isolated storage access is a lot slower on the phone than it is on the desktop. And so the strategy on the phone has to be smart in the sense of, for example, if you have an application, you don't want to have to set up 50,000 records or even 10,000 records when that application launches, because you're going to have the customer sitting and looking at a spinning dial for or actually in the case of the phone, the dots moving back and forth for a long time. And so it is important to have that strategy of keeping the core important items that you need access to and the items that the user's saving on the phone, but to have something when it gets into the thousands of records, have some other repository. And I think that works well because very few users are going to themselves drive 1,000 updates at a given point in time. Typically, they'll be doing dozens of transactions before the phone comes online and makes that synchronization.
So let's back up a bit and talk about what's involved in setting up a database, setting up tables and indices on Windows Phone or Silverlight. Tell us a little bit about what the steps are involved in creating a basic relational database to sit on top of isolated storage.
Sure. So, you know, one of the things when I was looking at what was out there, there were a few commercial options and some other options ported. And one problem that I had with the options I saw was they all required that you derive your data classes from some other class and you basically follow a convention. You know, some only had support for integer keys. And I said, you know, data is not really like that. And especially on the phone, if we can avoid making artificial keys where it's not necessary and we have a unique piece of business data, that should really be the key for the data. So the way that I built Sterling was to allow you to set it up easily and hopefully use your existing classes with little to no modification. So essentially what you do is there's a base class provided by Sterling that you derive from, and this defines the database. And in that definition, you basically give it a name, and Sterling will support multiple databases in the same application. And the only reason you would want to do that is, for example, to maybe manage multiple versions. So you might have a version 1 database and a version 2 that you can migrate between. But in addition to that, you basically only have to define 2 things to define a table definition and let Sterling start using that. That's the type of the class that you want to persist and the lambda expression that points to the key for that class. And so that allows it to be very flexible. So if I have a contact record and I'm using an integer ID, I define it as a contact type. And then I would provide a lambda expression that says, here's how you get that integer key. So, you know, C goes into C.ID.
And am I right that as the owner of the database, I'm responsible for the uniqueness of that key?
Correct. You are responsible. The key should be unique. And I've got a guide online that's linked to from the project that talks about this. Keys can be composite. Keys can be a lot of different things, but they should be unique. And you're responsible for that. Sterling's not going to do any checks. So if you give me a completely different class with the same key, Sterling is going to assume, oh, you want to update the class with that key, and it's just going to perform an update operation instead of coming back and saying, hey, you know, you already have something with that key. It gives you the facility to check that, though. You can query and you can check, and we also have a concept of triggers that can provide some validation, but Sterling does expect you to provide it with a unique key.
And what about joins? Can you take 2 tables and join on foreign keys and so forth?
Absolutely. And I mean, I think that's one of the very powerful features that Sterling provides beyond just serializing objects in and out. And there's an example that's on the desktop version that we're converting to the phone version that uses a food database. And so the food database has categories and food items, and then all these subcategories of fat and protein and carbs and all of these linked items, and gives an example of using a query. And so what you can actually do is perform any type of query, filter, join that link can provide over the indexes and the keys. You can actually do that over the objects themselves, but if you do it over something that's not in the key or a defined index, it will have to deserialize the object first, and of course that's going to impact performance. So that's sort of the balance and the strategy, is figuring out which properties are used the most often so that those can be placed in the keys and indexes, and then you can query, join, filter, sort, pretty much anything you want to do before you pull that data out of storage.
Let me just make sure that I have this right. Let's assume that we're comfortable saying that we're only going to join on indexed properties. Then if I have, let's make this simple, let's say I have customers and their orders. So each customer would have a customer ID, and that would be the key. And then let's say the customer has a first name, last name, and phone number. And then each order has an order ID and a date and a general description. Are you saying that the order ID would be the key that you join on, or are you saying that you make a specific field that you then index to join on, or how do you go about doing that?
Sure. So typically, if you're using the IDs, then you can join on the IDs, just as you mentioned. So it's what someone would be used to, for example, in a SQL server, but you can still filter on the fields. And a good example, I like the customer and orders, because maybe you say, give me all the orders for customers with this last name. And so your join statement would join based on the order ID into the customer, but the filter would filter on the last name. But another example I think really helps people understand the power of this is if you're talking about recipes, because I can have a recipe, and then that recipe has a list of ingredients, which is an amount and a food item. And I might want to say, give me all the recipes that have salmon. And so basically, this join will filter on the food table, say, give me foods with salmon in the name, and then take the ID of the recipe that food item belongs to and join to the recipe, and then pull back that list of recipes. So you can join both ways, and as long as you keep the joins to the fields that are defined as keys and indexes, it's pretty much doing an in-memory linked object join.
That's great. So in that particular example, the two IDs and the name, salmon being a name of the food, the salmon would be in the index and the IDs would be the keys. And
That's
so
correct.
everything would stay in memory.
Yes.
Okay, that seems pretty straightforward, pretty clear. You can do order by, I believe you said, you can order your results.
Yes, you can order, you can even group your results. I have examples where data is being summarized, and so what it will do is actually use a group by and then create a anonymous type that has summary details and then throw that up on the UI.
And this is all using link syntax.
That's correct.
Let's talk about using Sterling as a repository for offline and updating a database, an online database from that repository. You suggested that that's a model that you're comfortable with. Can you talk a little bit about how you might set that up?
Sure, and there's a lot of different concurrency scenarios, and this is one thing we run into all the time. At Wintellect, we work on a lot of line of business enterprise type applications, and concurrency is an issue. Sterling will focus on obviously what's local to the user, and typically in a Silverlight scenario, or even the phone scenario, you're going to have one user at a time. The question is, you have 100,000 users on 100,000 different phones, and they're all updating this central server. So a lot of times what can happen is you basically tag a transaction level. And again, let's give an example with the recipe. And so with a recipe, I've got a description, I've got my instructions step by step, I've got my ingredients. And so any one of those items might be edited. But what's important to me is really the recipe level, right? Has this recipe changed or not? So for Sterling as a repository, and again, this is something that is something that the user will have to build in. It's not automatic, but we're looking at ways to make it automatic, is typically you'll define a concurrency identifier, for example, a GUID, that flags the version of the record. Some people like to use date stamps, but the problem with date stamps is you get into issues when the phone's date isn't synchronized with the server's date, and then it gets confusing who wins and who is really most recent. So I like to use GUIDs, and it's a very simple activity where if I have a local cache of the database and I update it, I update that GUID. And then what happens is when the phone comes online, your process can basically send a list of recipe IDs and GUIDs. So we're not even sending the full records. We're just sending a short list, and the server can compare and say, okay, this matches, this matches, this matches, but these are different. And then once they're different, that's when you have the opportunity to say, you know, okay, what are my rules? Some people say that, you know, the customer on the phone always wins, right? Because they edited it locally. If it's a deal where, you know, there's more sensitive changes, like you'd never want that to happen in source control, right? The last person to check in wins, it'd be a disaster. Then you can, you know, add that logic to say, okay, give me the record that you have and let's compare them and let the user make a choice. But it really comes down to having some unique identifier that's refreshed when the record's touched, and the server will do the same thing. And then you can, as a first step, just say high level, are these the same or not? And if they're different, then you can start drilling down and saying, okay, what is different? Is it the text field? Is it the ingredients list? And have that level of granularity.
Okay, that makes really good sense. And just to be clear here, the logic for what it means to be different and the logic for saying, okay, I've discovered that it is different and now I'm going to upgrade to the server, that would all happen at the application level, not at the database level.
That's correct.
Okay. So what the database, the way to use this database is to think of it as a way to store and retrieve rapidly in that environment on top of isolated storage, but not as a way to integrate with another database or synchronized with another database.
Correct. And so that's, I mean, it's a issue that's inherent in the difference between Sterling being more object-oriented. It does have relationships, but it's object relationships versus the database, which is typically a traditional relational database. So there is some mapping. There's not a direct one-to-one. And my intention when building Silverlight was not to compete with something that may come out down the road like a SQLite, because that's definitely a different scale and level. And there's, you know, teams of people who have worked on these code bases for years. And so it was more to look at that local strategy. Now, having said that, I was very surprised at the sweet spot it hit, where there are a lot of people who have smaller databases that they're saying, you know what, I don't want the overhead of a bigger SQL relational database or this or that. So I like Sterling because it's just short, small, and sweet, and I'm not going to have a lot of data. And so they've asked, can you put Sterling on the desktop so that we can do a direct one-to-one synchronization of actual objects between the desktop and the client? So that's one thing we're looking at. And also had another discussion about, well, what about something like Azure and table storage? Would it be possible if I don't want the full-blown SQL, but the object-based storage isn't enough to give me sort of what I need, would it make sense? So there's a lot of exciting possibilities of what we're exploring with where it can go.
Can you tell us a little bit about some of the advanced features that we haven't discussed yet?
Sure. These are pretty exciting to me, too, because they're things that people run into and can drive people crazy sometimes. But one of them is just the depth of the serialization. So a lot of the built-in serializers only go one level deep, so whatever the top-level properties are. Sterling will recursively walk through the entire object graph. It doesn't matter if it's 5 to 30 levels deep, and will serialize everything that it can find. If there's a type that it doesn't understand, maybe it doesn't have a parameterless constructor, so it can't create that, you can provide a custom serializer and register it with the engine and tell Sterling how to serialize it. So it's flexible in that sense. It handles cycle detection and circular references. So what that means is if I go 5 levels deep and suddenly I'm pointing to the object that's the parent, so I have class A, class B, class C, and class C points up to class A, it will know that and remember that and still handle serializing and deserializing correctly. It will also handle what we call foreign keys. It's not the same concept as a foreign key in a relational database, but it's very close. And that means, say I have class A and it has a list of class B, and both classes are defined as tables. When I serialize class A in Sterling, it will only serialize the keys for class B. And then when it's deserialized, it'll go out and load those individually, so that if somewhere else you make a change to class B with key 5, that change will be reflected when you load class A that contains the list. So it handles that, and it's not creating multiple copies of that second class all over the place.